Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. We're going to open another chapter in the endless book of consciousness today. I've been thinking a lot about initiation lately, the idea of initiation. You know, traditionally you think of initiation as something that happens with somebody who has some kind of authority, like you're studying Zen, and then you hang around for years, and you do all this work, and then finally you get initiation. You know, you get the zap from the person who got a zap, from a person who got a zap, from a person who got a zap, all the way back to the Buddha. So the story goes. But there's all kinds of initiations, you know. There's the formal initiations into a esoteric order, into a religion. But then there's the way that your experience can initiate you. That if it's really something that has authority that gives you a spiritual initiation, that sometimes it's only your own experience. You can be in nature. You can be alone. It could be a dream. It could be a book. It could be a conversation. And I was thinking about this because our guest today, Miguel Connor, who runs the Aeon Byte podcast, which I suspect many of you are aware of, and if you're not, you should be, describes on the website that he describes Aeon Byte on his website as an initiation by conversation. And I love that idea. I love the idea that their initiations are waiting for you everywhere you look. You never know when one's going to happen. And maybe you think it's initiation, later on you realize it was just a good time. But there are those things that you read, that you see, that you experience, that you undergo, that you encounter, that change you permanently, that open up something, that create a relationship that you can't put back into the box in some easy way. And sometimes it is through books, and sometimes it is through chatting. And I know that my initiation into Gnosticism, the ideas of Gnosticism, the haunting magic of this ancient mystery that's still so hard to pin down even after scholars have been going at it like mad for quite a long time, was also very much an initiation through books. Through reading Hans Jonas's The Gnostic Religion, through reading Philip K. Dick, through reading some of the Nag Hammadi texts that were available in inexpensive paperback editions when I was a little one, and so it's just with that idea of initiation in mind that I'd like to think about conversations, think about how we listen to conversations, how we conduct conversations, how we meet people through dialogue, and that even in that place where there's the authority isn't between a master and a student, but just two bumbling seekers, or three, or four, or five, which is what most of us are, that even in that situation there's a spark that can grow. And with that little homily, I'd like to bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, the White Witch of Los Angeles, astrologer extraordinaire, Maja Dau. How are you doing, Maja? Oh, you're not there. Mysterious.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you.
Oh, good.
You did a little, mysterious disappearing act. Once again, can't keep it down. Have you had conversations that you thought were, they weren't even like, you didn't think they were necessarily going to be special, you were just chatting with someone, and something happens. Reveals something, and then you're changed. Something's happened there that's really initiated.
In fact, it's very synchronistic that you bring this up with conversation, because I just watched that movie, My Dinner with Andre.
Great example.
Yeah, totally perfect example. And I had just watched that literally two nights ago. So that topic of triggering initiation through conversation has been a hot one on my mind lately. And I have noticed that you can almost, like, try and do it on purpose to people. Like, that's kind of something I'm like a rogue initiation trigger, some people have said, where I'll just, like, sink in these little, like, triggers into conversations I have with people that'll, like, try and creak open their brains into that initiatory space a little bit. So you can do it, like, unconsciously and have it happen, like, without being aware of it, or you can actually kind of try to steer it in that direction. So I think that happens all the time.
And sometimes it's the information that's coming through. It's not because there's anything particularly special about you or the way that you're setting up the idea. It might just be that there are certain...
Totally.
Ideas like, you know, let's take the basic Gnostic idea that the creator of this world, of this cosmos, is a fallen, perhaps even evil being, and that the true God lies beyond. Now, that's a pretty striking idea. And if you're just growing up, at some point you're going to get that idea. You might get it through The Matrix, you might get it through Philip K. Dick, or you might get it, you know, through reading about ancient, you know, Gnosticism. And when you get that idea for the first time, that can really, you know, blow your mind, even if it's someone just mentions it at a cocktail party or something.
Yeah.
And it's with that spirit that I'd like to invite Miguel Connor onto the show. Hey, Miguel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on, and I am ready to be initiated into the mystery. Oh, and I would advise also, I think you should get the My Dinner with Andre action figures. They're fun.
That's right. You could like throw your voice in them. You know, create your own conversations.
Yeah, for hours. Yeah.
Hey, well, you know, I always like to kind of start the show out asking people about, well, how they got where they are, and in particular with you. I mean, you've more than like almost, I think really more than any podcaster that I know, or at least that I listen to. Have really devoted yourself to, for quite a long time, to a certain zone, you know, Gnosticism being at the kind of at the core of it, but there's a lot of related zones as well. And I'm just really curious, what was it about Gnosis at that point in your life when you're cruising along? I know you're a science fiction writer as well, and, you know, can't be, you know, and then you sort of open up this other space. What was it that led you in that direction?
Well, I usually don't talk about my mystical experiences because I always feel, you know, they're just hearsay and whatnot. But I might as well go and do that. I can first say that Gnosticism, to me, satisfied philosophically, theologically, and even practically all the questions I've been looking for. Because I feel like most religions, A, give you the pie-in-the-sky promise, and B, basically just kind of give you these coping skills to live through life, you know, happiness, peace, whatever. Things that are, you know, ultimately ephemeral. To me, Gnosticism was honest because it told me, and I think you and I discussed it the other day while doing my show, that there are no guarantees and that coping skills don't matter. You were talking about initiation. And I believe that the thing about initiation is that it's not about evolution, where you're sort of like wriggling around in a system that's already around you, or growth, where you're just adding more manure to the manure that was already there. But the point of initiation is that something brand new replaces the old. It's complete transformation. And to me, Gnosticism told me that the only way out of here, said the Joker to the thief, was through transformation. And of course it answered the questions that, you know, plagued Jung and other people, you know, the cause of evil, the cause of suffering, and so forth. I don't know if I'm babbling along because I tend to, but I can tell you about my mystical experience if you'd like.
Well, of course, we love that kind of stuff here.
My favorite.
All right, well, I'd already been studying Gnosticism, read, you know, probably the same books you had, Hans Jonas, Philip K. Dick, and my mind was wrapping around it finally after a while. But I'm part of this group called the Santo Daime, which is basically a Brazilian shamanistic group that has Christian trappings so they don't get in trouble. So, you know, you replace the old gods with Christian names and so forth. And my uncle is a patriarch in Lisbon, Portugal, where I'm from. So when I go back home, or, well, even here in the United States, when I can, I go there, and the ceremony involves ayahuasca. And I did it one night, and it's a really long ritual. We're talking 8 hours of just, you know, banging the drums and dancing and praying and talking. And, you know, sometimes you can't even, you forget you're high because it's so intense. But I had this out-of-body experience or hallucination, call it what you want, and I saw myself floating outside of the universe, and I kept floating and floating and floating. And what I saw is I saw what I thought, and I called this guy Abraxas, but then now that I look back, he was more like Azathoth from the Lovecraft mythos, you know, that idiotic god with all the flute players. I could see these satellites going around him. And it was all darkness. And I said to myself in this, you know, disembodied form that, oh, my God, this is the universe. This is worse than I could ever thought. This is a complete giant trap, labyrinth, with every single part of it trying to keep what little specks of light are out there, what little, you know, Atmans are floating out there. And this is worse than I could ever imagine. And the only reason I came out of this vision is my aunt, who lived like two houses down, she had a premonition, and she suddenly just storms into this very private ceremony where you're not supposed to have outsiders, especially once you've drank the ayahuasca and everybody's in their trances, and just broke in and just started shaking me out of it. And, you know, everybody started freaking out, and, you know, one of the elders said, yeah, Miguel, you might have gone too far. You might have not come back because you get stuff like near-death experience and stuff, and the elders are supposed to always keep an eye on you. But that, to me, told me that maybe there was something to it, you know, why my aunt had a premonition to come and save me from just going out of nowhere. And to that day, that has really strengthened my Gnostic predisposition and quest or jihad or whatever you want to call it.
Well, you've opened up so many amazing questions. I got to just get one right that's a little bit of a side note, and then we're going to come back. But just because I'm so curious, is that how long – so your aunt and uncle were associated with Daimi in Portugal.
Well, my uncle's been doing it for the last 10 years. My aunt is not –
okay.
Involved in it at all. She's into the Course of Miracles. She's actually pretty much against Santo Daime.
Amazing. What a rich, I just never thought about, of course, the role of the church in Portugal, especially where there's this language connection as well. But to get back to that vision, you know, it's such a funny thing because I have often had very dark, labyrinthine, mechanical, trap-like visions and dreams and predilections and resonances whether I read it in fiction or not. And then I have a whole other set of things that don't have that kind of character. And as I go along and talk to people, it's a really remarkable thing because it sort of seems that some people get that vision and some people get something very different. And I no longer even know how to sort of square them. But what I have come to do is to really honor that trap vision more than you are sort of encouraged to in sort of general spiritual seeking circles. You know, there's just this assumption that we're all, like you say, evolving towards the light, and that there's this spirit in the earth that's moving forward, and we're bringing, you know, and sometimes you're like, no, it's a...
No, yes. I'm with you, man. I'm with you. Yeah, I can't buy into that. I mean, ever since that vision, and I think I feel very, very kindred to the prophet Mani, because, you know, he was the one that said, yeah, God is in everything, but unfortunately God is trapped in everything. He's trapped in the rock, he's trapped in the tree, he's trapped in us. So yeah, nature is beautiful, but the whole point is that nature also wants to get out of this hellhole. And so do we, you know? We're all in this together, but not for this cosmic consciousness, let's codepend, you know, let's exist in this codependence and all this stuff. I mean, it's just not going to work. I mean, I always tell people, you know, it's not that you know, as the Orthodox say, the Titanic will sink, or other people saying the Titanic is sinking. The Titanic already sank. We're floating in an ocean of existentialist despair and this cold ignorance. So maybe when we start seeing that, that's when we can actually start getting to some real work instead of putting Band-Aids on stuff like we have for 2,000 years.
Well, one of the things that I really admire about your, even as I find out more from you now about your kind of personal experience and the your own hunches about the nature of the universe, is that that one of the ways that you've explored it is to have this running engagement, not just with, you know, having conversations and making a podcast and exploring these things, but specifically connecting in a very interesting way with scholars of this material. Because one of the things about Gnosticism that's so interesting, but also kind of difficult about getting into it, is that on the one hand, there's this kind of, what you want to say, living current that does go through William Burroughs and Philip K. Dick and The Matrix and, you know, people like you who are having your experiences in reading science fiction, and, you know, you're interested in religion as well, but it's this kind of, you know, countercultural current. And it's even countercultural to a lot of spiritual stuff, because, as we said, that tends to emphasize sweetness and light, and the darkness of the vision of a trap, of the universe being a trap, is just a little too much. So even that is kind of a countercultural. And then at the same time, there's the fact that our whole sense of what Gnosticism is, our living sense of Gnosticism, is also based on the recovery and the reading and the interpretation and the dense, minute scholarly work on the actual materials, of which there are sort of synchronistically so many more now than there used to be. And so that creates a really interesting space for engaging with scholarship, because you have these very personal motivations and interests that are spiritual and theological as well as intellectual. And then you spend a lot of time, as you collected in the book that sort of sparked this conversation, which you haven't even mentioned, Voices of Gnosticism, which is sort of a best of from Aeon Byte, but, you know, specifically focusing on the heavy duty scholars that you've gotten on the show. I'm really curious about that, like how you see your role in bringing the concerns you have to the conversation of scholarship and these real, you know, big questions that are going on that if you're not paying attention to, they don't seem like they're very important, but if you recognize the validity of this spiritual current, they become very important.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, Voices of Gnosticism is kind of the cliff notes of Gnosticism, if you would. But I think a lot of people, and, you know, And it goes with New Agers, it goes with mainstream Christians, it goes with a lot. They tend to thumb their nose at scholars, and I find that pretty unfair, not because I want more gifts. Of course I want more gifts, but what I see is these scholars have spent their very lives studying this material, and they're just not interested in gathering data, but they're also interested in processing it. So these scholars basically walk the path of the ancient Gnostics. You know, they breathe the air. They want to feel what their culture was like around there, that pressure cooking of the Roman Empire that was coming down on them. They want to see through their eyes and know exactly what they were thinking in order to simply write their books and their papers. And they spend, I mean, you know, a scholar can spend, you know, 6 months translating, you know, 6 pages in Coptic and trying to get the right word. So what I see, and I think people really get in Voices of Gnosticism, is that the Gnostics really do speak through these scholars. I mean, if you read some of the passages, like when April the Conic is starting to talk about the Sethian passion for astrology and theurgy and Egyptian magic, I mean, she almost takes you to these magical places. When Marvin Meyer starts to talk about the Gospel of Judas and the hero role of Judas and the priest role of Judas, you really feel inspired. Or Einar Thomason starts really talking about the poetic philosophy and mysticism of Valentinus and his many views on Jesus, which were so varied, and they're all so beautiful. I think it's better than listening to any theologian, and it's far better listening to any, Gnostic priest that I've heard, and I've been to many Gnostic services. So I think, and so even if you say it's a matter of osmosis, you know, these scholars get it. They're there. And you can say that about any historian. I'm sure any historian of...
I think that the situation you're describing is a little unique. I definitely don't think, in some of the scholars and historians I've met, certainly when dealing with especially occult or Egyptian history, they will actually remove themselves from it entirely and look at it in that very, reductionist, white man viewing a pagan culture type of thing. I think that a lot of the scholars that you get to interact with are indeed very special, amazing people that go through that immersion of putting themselves in it. And I think there's a few different types of scholars and historians, and I think that when you can actually find someone that gets into the material on the level of being involved with it personally, I mean, that's like a lot of the folks we talk to on our show are folks that are actually personally involved, whereas, I mean, you look at the state of the world today with judgment, and it's because people view it as reductionist and outside of themselves and part of this interesting phenomena that happens that isn't included in themselves at all. So I think that the people you work with are definitely exceptional in that area.
No, I would have to agree. I mean, they are the creme de la creme, and they didn't get where they get by not, utilizing their full capabilities and, again, getting into the skin of the Gnostics. That's why, we chose these 13 scholars. And that's why they are the scholars that they are. That's why they are Elaine Pagels or Bart Ehrman and so forth. So and that's certainly what happened. So, and I do agree with you on your other point.
Well, I think it's also that there's something about this particular material that kind of communicates itself through study and thinking and poetic images and interpretation. Like the very... That we talked about this on the show the other day is that one of the things that's interesting about the Gnostics, or to use a general term which itself is a little problematic, which we might talk about, but just for general purposes it certainly serves, is that they presented very very unusual interpretations of things that other people in the culture, thought of as one way. So, once again, coming to the idea that, if you were a first or, second century Jew or Christian who was familiar with the Jewish Bible, that you would know the story of Adam and Eve, and they eat this thing and they get kicked out, and then to hear that hey, that story, yeah it's true, it's just that the God in that story is not the true God, he's actually an imposter or a forger or an abortion. That is such a striking, it's almost like, it's like paranoid conspiracy theory. It's like, those guys, they're actually lizards from Arcturus or whatever the story is. But it's about interpretation. It's about how you read and reread the world and mythology and Christ. And so when you read through the Gnostic materials, and including the scholarship where they're all dealing with this interpretive questions about single words and things that are very minute, nonetheless, you're part of this kind of larger interpretive enterprise that communicates something on a deeper level than the particular arguments. At least that's my experience. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. I think you hit it on the nail in many ways. I mean, obviously, translations are essential because the whole fight, and in my book, Voices of Gnosticism, it definitely gets exposed with... you have April DeConnick, who goes, no, Judas was not just the son of the Demiurge, but he was a son, he was an archon who has Gnosis. We're talking about he's Agent Smith. This guy can threaten the Matrix itself. But then you have Marvin Myers saying, no, this is the ultimate high priest. And it all goes by, simple translations, because the word daemon in certain times was a positive word, but in certain times, it's a negative word. So you got to nail what century it was, what context it is, and a simple word like that can change the entire text. So, I mean, this is important stuff. And I love what you said, because I mentioned this the other day on another interview, but you're right. The Gnostics were the first conspiracy theorists, because they turned around and said, whoa, time out. Not just our supreme being, and that takes a lot of cojones to say, but all the gods are part of this conspiracy to destroy us. I mean, they are the cosmic BP, or they are the cosmic Monsanto, or the cosmic Rothschild, and we need to wake up. And not just that, but we are going to distrust every single facet of society and reality, and we're going to deconstruct it and reinterpret it and keep deconstructing it until there's nothing. So that's another reason why I really like the Gnostics. And, of course, well, like any conspiracy theorist, things didn't go very well for them.
Well, I think related to that also is the fact of Christianity, that we're still living in the shadow of Christianity, not just because it's still a living, you know, religious form that has tremendous political power, but because even the structure of the modern world, our secular scientific world, emerges from the matrix of Christianity and has more to do with it than a lot of times we think when we think of ourselves as being in a secular age. And so really, I mean, if you're looking at like world history, like, you know, whatever, 6,000-7,000 years of like recorded history, you know, what happens with not so much the life of Christ himself, if he was actually a person who was alive, but what happens right after that with the emergence of Christianity is really this, like, one of the most important, you know, bifurcation points in the whole history of history. And there's something that's interesting about Gnosticism is it rises, it's right around that time, and it's kind of this like shadow world where other possible Christianities emerged and then were sort of swallowed up. And even that fundamental, you know, one of the basic scholarly arguments is whether we should consider Gnosticism a variant of Christianity or as a current that pre-exists Christianity and takes certain forms under Christianity, influences Christianity. But it's not so much about the specific arguments right now, though those are interesting. It's just the fact that Gnosticism gives you this weird, you know, kind of countercultural angle into the origins of Christianity, which is, you know, so significant in terms of world history.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Gnostics, again, back to our conversation, that's a conundrum. How long can you be countercultural before you just become part of the culture, before the system immediately swallows you up? I think the Gnostics will always be countercultural, and so far history has deemed them always countercultural, whether you talk about the Cathars, the Manichaeans, or Philip K. Dick, or how the psychologist community really thinks of Jung, and so forth. But I think what makes the Gnostics always countercultural is this huge skepticism that they have, this huge habit of deep inquiry and always deconstructing everything they see. And if you have that Gnostic spirit, you're always going to be countercultural. And plus, you know, as all the Gnostics always talk about, they always talk about Jesus as the allogenist, the stranger, or the Gospel of Thomas as become a passerby. You know, they're always stressing that you need to be on the outside looking in, on the fringes, and make sure you're taking notes of what's going on.
That's a great line. I got to remember. Make sure you're taking notes as well. That's part of the key. But we got to take a break now, and we'll be right back after these messages. This is Eric Davis with Maja Daou. We're talking with Miguel Connor on Expanding Mind. We'll be right back.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Virginia Reed, and I'll see you this Friday talking about Long Day's Journey Into Night. We'll have both the director and the main actors, both male and female. This is Virginia Reed. I'm very happy I'm back, and I can't wait to see you all this Friday again on PRN.
I'm Elaine Snipa, host producer of Evolving Ideas. Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
Is someone driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your Life, Your Relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at progressiveradionetwork.com.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Radio Network. I'm Maja Bahu, and we're here with Eric Davis talking to Miguel Connor, who just wrote a book of a collection from Aeon Weiss called Voices of Gnosticism. And I wanted to bring the topic back, if I could, to initiation, just because I think a lot of what we just talked about is concerning that, and how when we talked to Dr. Holler, one of the things he mentioned was that, you know, the nature of the Gnostic material itself causes people to go through an initiatory experience. And I think that relates to what you and Eric were talking about, how they, you know, the Gnostics were this, like, kind of conspiratorial group that presented something which was very different than, you know, kind of what the accepted level of consciousness was in a lot of ways. And I think it's fascinating that, I mean, the scholars that you work with, as you mentioned, really are in it. And I think part of that is the Gnostic material causes people to go through these initiatory experiences, like Carl Jung, or like, you know, people mentioned that you just get into it and it just initiates it. It triggers it no matter what. And so what I was curious about is if you had seen anything where you had been having a conversation about Gnosticism with people and you could see them having like an existential crisis, like realizing, oh my God, like, what if this is true? I know for me, like, when I've been talking to Christians, I'll bring up something about, like, the Sethians or some Gnostic group, and they have, never heard of them or didn't even know it existed, and they'll, I can almost see in their eyes that something is getting triggered in them. So that idea of initiation through conversation, I wonder if you could give us a good example of how you've seen that go down.
Sadly, I don't think I could give you a good example, because even most of the time when I have a conversation and there is this connection, and maybe they do see the Gnostic worldview, because it's almost impossible to deny it once you really start looking out at the world and this wonderful predatory universe. But they very quickly will go back into the safety of, again, these coping skills. I don't think they're fully, you know, they're fully initiated. I'm tongue-tied here. They've gone through any initiation because they're not transformed. I agree that with Philip K. Dick, to an extent, even though I'm getting really esoteric here, and he was the one who said that the Nag Hammadi doesn't give you information, but it is living information. It's almost like a holy virus that turns into what he called a homoplasmate, and then you become part of the secret Christians who are no longer beholden to time and space. So, but I think the Gnostics do answer a lot of very broad questions that all Christians really have in their mind. I mean, all of us probably sat down as kids and we were either reading some, you know, a very nice pop-up book with the Israelites, you know, slaughtering people, or the flood story. And then we would think, like, is this really the father of Jesus? I think everybody's gone through that. And suddenly you have the Gnostics 2,000 years ago saying, hey, yeah, no, he wasn't. He was not the father of Jesus. They're two separate entities. And there's a whole other slew of questions. You know, the question of reincarnation. All of us probably, you know, maybe not as children, but later on said, well, reincarnation is possible. I have had experiences. The literature looks good. But there's nothing in Christianity about it. And again, you turn to the Gnostics, and they say, whoa, lo and behold, the Gnostics says they never actually, you know, signed off, but they definitely, a lot of sects said, yes, it is possible, although like the Eastern faiths, they say, but don't worry about it, but it is possible. So Gnosticism does offer a lot of this broad view, and in their conspiracy theories mode that we keep going back to, they do tend to answer a lot of your suspicions that anyone's had. You know, we all wonder about Mary Magdalene. You know, it seems there's something more to this girl who gets mentioned 3 or 4 times in the Bible. Lo and behold, she was one of the main apostles of Jesus. Judas. God, there's something wrong about this guy. And yes, I've seen The Last Temptation of Christ, or I've seen Jesus Christ Superstar. And that's really cool in fiction. And oh my God, people really did think that way back then. So in that sense, Gnosticism does offer a whole ocean, or the breaking of the dam of a lot of our, you know, cognitive dissonance we've had as Christians.
Well, yeah, that's a great point. I was just thinking about this the other day, and I tweeted about it. I had this idea that I've had it for a while, that like in our society, in the West, you know, really, any, you know, anywhere that they're even mildly plugged in, it's like we all have a Jesus in our head. There's no way out. You got a Jesus, one, maybe many. You can't like have a worldview where there's not a Jesus. So why not like have a cool Jesus? You know, so, like, I was like, well, who's my Jesus? My Jesus is kind of like this '70s surfer hippie who's kind of a Gnostic and a little scary, but you know, he's fun to hang out with and he's really sweet. And, you know, so when people are talking about Jesus, like some creepy, you know, right-wing, scary person, and they're talking about Jesus, I'm like, they don't know Jesus. My Jesus wouldn't do that. And what I love about what you're just saying here with Gnosticism and just the question of early Christianity, when you fully take on the reality that in the second century, like decades and decades and decades after the man's gone, that there is no capital C Christianity, that there are myriad Christianities, that none of them are ahead of the pack, that they're all, some of them kind of coexisting, okay, and and that our whole idea of this notion of orthodoxy is such a later construct, that it helps, and I think it helps a lot of people come to terms with the way in which, on some level, they still are Christians. I mean, I know on some level, I wasn't raised really a Christian. I mean, we had Christmas, but I wasn't baptized. I didn't go to church. I mean, I knew the stories, but I learned the gospel from listening to Jesus Christ Superstar and identifying with Judas, you know, so I was screwed from the get-go. But I think it's a way that allows a lot of people to come to terms with
that which is unique in Christianity, or at least has a unique spin, particularly that idea of, like, freedom from law. That's that Pauline notion is so powerful, that there's this law that's constraining us, but that there's this moment of grace, there's this opening, there's a kind of liberty in that. And Gnosticism reflects those things in very rich ways that I think, like, allows a kind of parallel Christianity to modulate rather than just simply atheistically reject the Christianity that is still really driving our culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know I can improve on that, Eric.
Were you raised Christian?
Yes, I was raised Catholic, but we were always very ecumenical before ecumenical was, like, in vogue with Catholics. So my family always urged me to seek different spiritual experiences. My mom would go to different services. My aunt, who's a nun, would read the Buddhist sutras. So we were always very open-minded about things. And nobody in our family or even in our little church around, Portugal thought that the only salvation was through the Catholic Church. I mean, I'm not one of those guys who went to Gnosticism or whatever religions I've done because I was so scarred and hurt, you know? I made peace before I go anywhere. So.
That's a good style.
Yeah, because the problem you have with a lot of, I see it in modern Gnostics, and maybe pagans are the same way, is that it's not because they stand for something, is that it is what they stand against that what defines them. And I think that's terrible. I think they're playing right into the hands of the demiurge.
Well, then let's stay on that point and say, to sort of drill down, what does a modern Gnostic stand for? Or what's one version of that from your perspective?
Well, I've definitely railed against a lot of what the modern Gnosticism has become. And what worries me, and this goes back to the scholar thing, is that there's a rich, vast, fertile soil in the Nag Hammadi that is just waiting for you to go and take and plant your seeds in. But a lot of modern Gnostics and scholars, again, rail about this because the word Gnosticism or the Gnostics were revived so often throughout history by occultists and esotericists, and they didn't have many of the main texts. All they had was the polemics of the church fathers who said there were a bunch of just, orgy-attending, baby-eating, semen-drinking kind of dudes. And all that. So a lot of the modern Gnostics are still stuck on this kind of Crowley, Blavatsky, Golden Dawn type of Gnosticism, which is nothing like what we find in the Nag Hammadi library when it comes down to it.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think about that? Like, would you say that the Nag Hammadi is really truly the only scholarly acceptable source available for, like, truly Gnostic entities? Or would you say, like, what about Egyptian material, or like the Book of the Dead, or like any of, like, what would you say is an acceptable source for people to say is Gnostic material if we can't go to any of the kind of occult places?
Well, I mean, I would say definitely, expand your mind. I mean, we know historically that the Gnostics were very inclusive. They hung out with the pagans, they hung out with the Christians. They practiced alchemy, they knew all about Egyptian magic. They knew about theurgy, they did meditation. So I would say, yeah, the whole point of Gnosis is not just, spiritual knowledge, but it's knowledge of everything in any way you can get your hands on. At the same time, there are things that are not Gnostics, but of course can supplement and, buttress the Gnostic viewpoint. But I would say the Nag Hammadi, and not all of the Nag Hammadi, because they're finding the Nag Hammadi is a porridge of all these Christianities
right.
That Eric was talking about. But you really first have to find out the Gnostic framework and then find these texts in the Nag Hammadi library plus other apocryphal texts that you find out there, like the some of the Askew Codex, the Bruce Codex, the Hermetic Writings, the Corpus Hermeticum, a lot of the Kabbalah, especially the later, more kind of negative, dualistic Kabbalah that you find in Isaac Luria and Shabbatai Zevi, a lot of the early Muslim writings on Jesus, which seem to be very influenced by the Manichaeans, and then there's a whole bunch of other things. But again, it's just
It's difficult to articulate exactly what is included in Gnosticism. I'm sure you and all the scholars like know this, but that is a point of contention in trying to figure out, like, well, okay, if I'm going to like just view Gnosticism, because they're just like Christianity, right? There's so many different kinds and inputs, and Buddhism is the same way. So I just, if you could, you know, let people know like what exactly would be like defining.
Or another way to say is like, what's a good secondary source, like an accessible scholarly overview that really gives you like a map? Like, is it like you mentioned the Brackey book recently? Maybe something else like that you could suggest.
Yeah, I do like David Brackey's book, The Gnostics, because he will give you the different arguments that all the scholars have had for the last 20 years, and he puts them down, and then he goes and he makes this case of who were the Gnostics. He pretty much whittles them down to the Sethians, and then everybody else is sort of, you know, on the outer edges of that. For books, that's a very hard one because there's so many good ones. If you want to get into the ethos and essence of Gnosticism, I would say The Gnostic Religion by Hans Jonas is an excellent source. I always tell people, well, go watch The Matrix. The Gnostics never said it had to be, you know, go watch The Truman Show. Read Valis. There's a whole bunch. Read The Invisible by Grant Morrison. You'll have the Manichaean religion right there. So there's definitely various sources you can find it. I mean, just as the Gnostics were inclusive and kind of wandered around in between religions and so forth, I would say you do the same thing. You've got to kind of, the Gnosis is going to come to you differently than it will come to you, to me. That aha moment is going to be different with each one of us.
Well, I wanted to ask you also, you had mentioned about the early church fathers' view and with the sexuality involved, and this is just, you know, my own thing is, you know, part of one of the etymologies of gnosis or to know is to have sex with, and that's been, you know, kind of this thing, and they related to that thing in the Bible when they say, like, Adam knew Eve, and, like, to know, part of the interpretation of that is actually intercourse. So I was wondering if, like, in any of your conversations or in, like, even the study of the Sethians, a lot of that comes up, and especially in the alchemical material, about that, like, conjunction of the opposites. Like, what role do you really think that sexuality played in ancient Gnosticism? I know that's kind of a big question, but is that, like, in the material?
Well, it seems that the Gnostics were of obviously using a lot of metaphors. And back then, we didn't have the metaphors we have now, you know, the industrial age and the technological age and stuff like that. So obviously, you know, sex had to be a big metaphor and to show what unity was, to show what initiation was and so forth. But all in all, the Gnostics, it's not that they had a negative view of sex, is that they saw it for what it was. And this is really not that radical, but of course the Gnostics had to take it to the extreme because that's how they were. Let me interject, because most people and some scholars are starting to see that the Gnostics were the masters of parody. A lot of what they were doing was creating parody. I mean, that John Stewart couldn't even do. I mean, they made a parody out of Genesis, out of the flood story, out of God, out of out of Peter, and they made very witty parodies. But of course, they also have deep, deep lessons within them. So sometimes we have to look at the Gnostic stories and not think of these strange sci-fi rock operas that they seem or science fiction. But simply is that they were doing a little parody and having a little fun. Having said that, the Gnostics basically saw sex for what it was, like the Greeks, that it was simply a lower passion. You could put it like the Stoics into the category of happiness or joy or sadness. These are things that come and go, you know, and orgasm just ain't that long. And so therefore they put it on a very lower level than what we should be doing as humans. And some even said, well, why are we bringing more slaves to the demiurge? And, I mean, this is an issue that people have today. Why are we populating our race? What are we bringing? All of us parents say, what am I bringing my kid into? The Gnostic simply said, you're bringing him into hell, into another prison. So they were pretty, I think they were, they would fall under the negative view of sex. Anything that seduces you to the material world is considered less than advisable. Very simple.
But at the same time, there's a sense that you get in some Gnostic writings, or at least in that general zone, if maybe not specifically, you know, the Sethian or however you want to define the core Gnostic essence. I think this is very true of Manichaeism later on, which is clearly very influenced by Gnosticism, and really in some ways is the biggest Gnostic religion we've ever seen in the history of the earth, that even if there is this core negativity and this kind of dualism that, of course, you know, modern spiritual seekers and New Agers and pagans hate, that even if they have, there is this kind of resistance to matter, that it's sometimes coupled with some very sort of, I don't describe, a kind of sweet, peaceful, engaged, wise. It's not this, like, you know, crazy-eyed prophet, like, we have to get out of here, you know, destroy your children, escape now. I mean, it has that element into it. But there's another side as well, and particularly you see that with some of the poetry, even with some Manichaeans or whatever. So how would you, to put it another way, how would you fold a Gnostic worldview into a life that is not just this, you know, nihilistic, you know, trap, instead something that opens up into, you know, that has some insight, some peace, some joy in the life that we lived.
Well, I think you bring up the Manichaean view, which you're rightfully so was the biggest one. I mean, these guys were complete pacifists, and yet they could convert in Asia and Europe at an alarming rate. I mean, these guys got kicked around by every religion in the world. And yet they were so popular and loved. Same with the Cathars. And obviously these guys were the most dualistic cats you could meet. I mean, there was no compromise with them. They were very ascetic, very encratic. They were vegetarian. Yet at the same time, they were the most, artistic. They love painting. They love poetry. And they really love nature. A Manichaean was not allowed to even walk on the grass because Mani said that God is in every blade of grass. They would sit there and just pray to the trees and hang out in nature. And it goes back to my prior point, is that they saw that, okay, this world is a prison, but everything is a prisoner. There is a divinity in everything, in every rock, in every tree, and they deserve the dignity and compassion that they can get. Furthermore, Mani took it even further. He said, look, in his mythology, when you have this war, and then you have these strange thing, this strange scene which the Archons start, you know, ejaculating, and their menses fall into the world, it's actually God himself, the true or alien God, who forms nature. And Mani said that the mechanics of the nature is already set for redemption. Light has already been taken up to the moon and been thrown into the sun every month. Again, he was using mythology. I doubt he took this literally. And the mechanism of the universe is already perfect for redemption. There's only one thing that's getting in the way, man. Man keeps screwing up. Mani said man is the entity in the universe that most needs to be redeemed. I mean, we are at the bottom. We are just basically traps for darkness, and we get in the way. But in that sense, when you look at this sort of dualism where there is light in everything, and this light wants to escape, and it doesn't want to suffer anymore, and it deserves better, you really find this amazing compassion, and in my experience, a really new and almost exciting view of the world. You know, I can look at this Lovecrafting universe and see amazing things about it, those little specks of light.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful answer. And I think that you feel some of that in certain veins of Buddhism. And I think in some ways the reason that Buddhism is popular for some people is that it acknowledges both sides, that it acknowledges the great joys of a peaceful life, of respecting life in everything, but it also, you know, if taken seriously, acknowledges the deep suffering that's inherent in existence, the reality and necessity of death and disease and disharmony, and you know, and so there's a realism there along with a certain kind of spark. But for me, even though I've learned a great deal from Buddhism and have practiced Buddhism and in some ways and you know, have that world view, there's also something about finding that same story in the West that makes a difference, you know, whether it's the mythic resonance, whether it's the historical function, I'm not really sure, but there is something really, really keen about that moment with the Manichaeans and that balance of recognizing the horror and also embracing the light.
Yeah, but Eric, see, the difference, what I see, because I also practice Buddhist, is that the Buddhists, we are child of the Greek, you know. I would go to a Buddhist temple, and I would be sitting there, and I'd ask the master, why is there evil? He'd say, well, don't worry about it, just get out of it. And I'd say, master, why is there suffering? Well, don't worry about it, just get after it. I'd be like, no, I am a child of the Greeks. I want to know the answers while I'm escaping. And Gnosticism gives you that because it's always about asking questions as you try to alleviate the suffering. So in that sense, for me, Gnosticism was, again, filled more things that Buddhism do. I have to ask questions. I have to know. I'm nosy, you know.
I love it, man. That's a wonderful response. Well, I just want to let people know we got to wrap it up here, that they can find out more about you and the show and the book on thegodabovegod.com. And, of course, your great podcast, Aeon Byte. From Eric Davis here with the Majidau. You've been listening to Expanding Mind. Thanks so much, Miguel.
Thank you. And don't forget those Dinner with Andre action figures.
Excellent. All right, folks, keep your minds open.